This episode is brought to you by Fast Enterprises. Fast helps motor vehicle agencies serve the public by delivering enterprise modernization projects on time and on budget every time. Improve customer service and be ready for whatever the future brings. Give Fast a call at 1-877-ASK-FAST or visit us on the web at fastenterprises.com. Welcome to AnvaCast, bringing news, information, and expertise to the Anva community. Here's your host, Ian Grossman. Enjoy the show.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to the AnvaCast. This week, we are taking a deeper dive into a publication that Anva published towards the end of 2020. It's a document that we did in collaboration with the Transportation Research Board, commonly referred to as the TRB, and it's called Trends Impacting the DMV of the Future. We've had many conversations in our community around what the DMV of the future looks like, and the Anva Board of Directors a couple of years ago decided to invest in a partnership with the Transportation Research Board to really dive deeper and produce a report that would help members navigate the future. So joining me this week to discuss the topic are the primary authors of that report, Nathan Higgins and Joe Zisman from Cambridge Systematics. Nathan, Joe, welcome to your first appearance on the AnvaCast.
Well, thanks for having us.
Let's go back to the beginning of the project. Certainly, Anva discussed with TRB this idea of going down this endeavor, and you were brought in very early on to help facilitate, manage, and produce the report. But this, not coincidentally, all occurred prior to any words like pandemic and COVID-19 and coronavirus. This was really looking at the DMV of the future, not even knowing what the last year was going to mean to impacting that. So can you take me back to those early conversations on the purpose and the mission of what we were doing, why we were doing it, not even knowing how much the 2020 was going to change that?
Yeah, sure. I mean, in the world of transportation and the world at large, of course, everything's changing. You know, in a lot of our long-range strategic planning work, we see that technology's changing, demographics are changing, the population is aging, people are urbanizing or suburbanizing. And we try and keep tabs on that. And this research project was great because it was the application of all of that future thinking towards what does a DMV need to do to respond to that. And all of these pressures, especially through technology and demographics, are really starting to come to the forefront with buzzwords. We're advancing on that hype cycle through big data and analytics and other things, and agencies are really starting to think about how they can apply these things and implement them in their agencies. So I think that there was enough pressures of change to make this a worthy endeavor even before the pandemic came around. And the pandemic did nothing but accelerate, especially the impacts on technology.
So for those that aren't familiar with these types of TRB projects, can you paint the picture onto how the process works? What does it mean to have a project panel with TRB, and what is that interaction like, and how does objective research play into that conversation, as opposed to, say, I think when people hear buzzwords like, we're doing a research project and producing a report, you get these images of scientists in a lab doing research and then producing their data. This is a little bit different the way we go about these kind of projects.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, so these projects, TRB and the kinds of research that we tend to do, are very practical, and they're meant to be implementable by the agencies. And so the panel, it's not typically a panel of researchers and PhDs who are thinking about doing very academic research. It's usually a panel of practitioners, executives, people within the industry who are going to be the ones who might be implementing the topic. And so they really try and help guide us as the researchers towards using what we find and making it the most useful for them. And so our job as the researchers through these TRB kinds of projects is to go and find the detail and the information that we think is going to be most useful and practical, and then synthesize it into something that we feel like people can really hang on to and put into practice.
So in this case, where do you go to find that? Because it's very practical. And, you know, despite what many believe, we still haven't found that real working crystal ball. So in terms of looking at a DMV of the future, where does one go to start unpacking what are the trends that are going to impact the way the DMV might work in the future?
Yeah, Joe, I'll start this one, but I think I'd like you to elaborate a little bit on it too. But I think, so the way that we usually think about this and approach it is that we find folks out there who are already doing the thinking about the topic. And so in this case, we interviewed a number of DMV executives in Canada and the US to ask them, you know, to pique their interest. You know, what keeps you up at night? What are the important topics that you see coming down the road that maybe you haven't been able to address yet, but that you want to in the future? What are the things we can help you figure out through this project and get you more detail about that you think is going to be important for the DMV of the future? And then we went and, you know, we did our literature review and research to support that. And Joe, maybe you could build on that.
Yeah, there's a couple of different sources that we build into the literature review in addition to the interviews. And the core of this was really entirely the interviews. One piece of it is research that AMVA has conducted before. So this is not the first research that AMVA has ever done. It's the first collaboration between AMVA and TRB. But we were building on an excellent body of prior work that AMVA had already produced on a lot of these topics. The other place that we can go, and this is where I think as consultants and people with some outside experience, we can bring some value, is into the zeitgeist. Nate had already referred to before the technological environment that we're in. And so there are some, to give an example, when we're talking about future mobility and autonomous vehicles, future mobility and autonomous vehicles are not subjects that came up heavily in our interviews. We did ask about them. But the interview participants hadn't considered them all that deeply, which is not surprising. They don't exist yet. However, the lessons of how autonomous technologies are going to be implemented and regulated in the public sector and the lessons of having some big companies. You know, you're going, if autonomous vehicles are fully implemented, right, the way to think about it is that you're going from hundreds of millions of drivers to maybe five or six big technologies and big software systems that will actually drive all the cars on the road, which means that the systems that are being tested, the customers, the test participants in a driver's test are all big tech corporations and large industrial conglomerates. And what does that do to what DMVs are, the business model that DMVs are used to? When they have to be dealing with these big tech companies that are making demands on them. So we were able to do something like recount in a little bit of detail the story of the Boeing 737 MAX, which illustrates one possible challenge, one possible failure state of when the public sector tries to regulate a big company that has serious corporate interests in making an autonomous system approved and putting it in the air.
So let's dig into that example a little bit more, because I believe future mobility was one of a number of themes that come through in the report in terms of ways to think about different areas that are going to impact the future. And if I remember from my reading of the report, you know, you've got not only future mobility, but the trends of telework, distance forward service, I believe as you categorized it, service for everyone, and connection, integration, and privacy. And I'd like maybe for us to touch on each of them a little bit, but let's continue with future mobility since you're on there. And so as you identify those trends of automation, vehicles that drive themselves so you don't have as many drivers, what's the takeaway from the paper, the conclusion of the panel that says to a DMV, in the next 5 to 10 years or even beyond, how do they have to start preparing now for what that impact's going to be for the way they operate or the role that they play as a government agency?
I think that in terms of the next 5 to 10 years, and we do get into this in the paper, right? Although it's future mobility, and although they aren't necessarily thinking about autonomous vehicles in their later kind of late stage autonomy, you know, 2050s, 2060s type self-driving cars, there are already what are called ADAS, driver assistance systems, that are implemented in cars right now, right? So Teslas are driving themselves to some extent. You have to keep your hands on the wheel, but the car will, in essence, control itself. And automakers are coming out with ever more advanced versions of that. And at a lower level, right, I think many of our cars may already have systems that ding when there's someone next to us and we can't change lanes, or, you know, softly guide the steering wheel back when we start to pass over the line. DMVs have already started to have to answer the question of how many of those systems can be in place for driver's tests, right? Even if you're testing a human driver, the challenge becomes how much assistance can that human driver have? And that's not necessarily an easy answer, right? It might be tempting to say, well, none. We're testing you, not the car. But on the other hand, if we're supposed to be testing people as they would be driving in an ordinary situation, if you have assistance systems on the road that you're using every day, why wouldn't you be able to use them in the test so that the test best simulates your real world driving environment? And I think different DMVs have settled on different answers to that. But that's, you know, the next 5 years are going to be all about that, right? That's the type of autonomy that we're going to see in the next 5 years for private vehicles, is ever advancing ADAS that leads into a Tesla style or a Volvo style autopilot system that when you're on the highway for 2 hours can essentially take over the car, but isn't operating in the way that we would think of. You know, you don't watch a Hollywood movie and see that type of autonomous vehicles within the 2020 to 2030 timeframe.
So I imagine that the issue of future mobility, especially as it relates to self-driving vehicles or the integration of ADAS systems, is probably of all the trends in the paper, the one least impacted by the pandemic. Many of us, you know, haven't spent as much time in our cars the past 12 months the way we had previously, whereas the other trends, as you mentioned at the outset, Nathan, have almost been put into fast forward because of the experience of the past year. But while they were put in fast forward, they still existed prior to the start of the pandemic. So let's talk about telework. I think is probably, you know, maybe one of the greatest examples of that. That was already on the panel's radar when the project started. And I'm sure that conversation quickly shifted as we went into, you know, more people working from home. So talk me through that journey around the conversation of telework.
Telework is one of those topics that I actually, you know, it might not have really been high on the radar for folks at the beginning, and then really, like you said, became a focus. We ran a workshop after the pandemic started with a bunch of executives to talk about the impacts and what folks were seeing come out because of COVID-19. And what we heard clearly from the DMV executives was, you know, 5 years ago, we were having conversations about things like telework, and it just wasn't feasible. People didn't understand how it could work, or that it would work, or that people would be productive, or that we could actually do all the things that we need to do remotely. And I think people were amazed, as they have been outside of DMVs as well, that this is actually something that you can do, that your employees can be productive, and in some cases can be more productive. So that's sort of the workforce. And then starting to think in about what you do with your customers and how you can accelerate and move some of the transactions that a DMV typically does from in-person brick and mortar to something that you do online, whether that's fully online or partially online. And, you know, it went in even so far as revenues have come down for folks to thinking about how they can peel back some of the brick and mortar locations that they might be considering having. You know, maybe they just don't have as many in the future because they have more of these things digitally. So it really did. I think it was a natural experiment that proved that it could be done. And now I think it'll support a lot of the digital transformation in the future.
And is this what's referenced in the paper as the distance forward service, or is that a different category? It sounds like they overlap there a bit.
I would say that they definitely feed into each other because, as Nate referenced before, If you have a distance forward service model that takes some of the human interaction and the demands on staff to interact with customers out of the equation, those staff can now do other things, right? You can deploy your personnel in ways that are more efficient and more productive. And some of those ways may be at home, right? So it turns into, if you're looking at lowering your facilities costs, if you're a state that's able to do that and isn't required to have a certain number of DMV locations per county, for instance, as I know some are, you know, that turns into a positive feedback loop because you need fewer people and those people can do other things that are useful for your agency. You know, you keep them, but you reassign them to other tasks. And they can do those tasks from home, and then you need fewer brick and mortar locations, which leads to more digital services, which leads to less need for staff, right? And so it turns into a little bit of a virtuous cycle in terms of lowering those brick and mortar resources. Obviously, you would keep the human resources intact. So that I think they are related.
And that's a great example of a topic that has been in the community for many years, this idea of moving services out of the branch office, whether that is online, whether it's by mail, by phone. There's all these different options to not have to bring somebody into the physical office, and really saw that go into hyperspeed with the reality of that was the only way to deliver services for a period of time. Did you see, was that the natural progression of the conversation in the panel, or was there an aha moment that said, this is really different now and propels us way into the future?
I'd say, I mean, it probably was probably kind of an aha moment for all of us because of how rapidly it happened. We all went overnight to work from home, and DOTs, the IT departments had to manage, you know, the telework components of it and also, you know, the customer service elements of it. And so I think it came to us, we were all dealing with the same issues personally. And when we finally got together to talk about the impacts of the pandemic, it was so obvious that that was one of the biggest things that had accelerated. And I think just because of the speed of it and how quickly the experiment came to play and how quickly everybody saw how valuable it was and how doable it was, that it became, you know, certainly a keystone piece of the research.
I also think we interacted with the DMV executives twice. We interacted with them once in an interview round in November and December of 2019. Which was obviously, you know, the pandemic, COVID existed, but wasn't, none of us were really aware of it. And then we interacted with them again after the pandemic had taken hold for what we thought was a fair amount of time, right? We did our COVID workshop in May of 2020, and we're all thinking, okay, well, we're like 75% of the way through this story now, you know, we'll all be back to work by August. And, so it felt like maybe when the pandemic was a fairly advanced story, looking back on it now, you know, all these months later, that seems kind of absurd. But the pandemic had clearly taken hold. And a lot of these discussions of distance forward service were already in place when we were talking to folks in 2019. You know, one of the things that's helpful to us, you know, both Nate and I are located in Boston, but talking to DMV folks from around the country is that there are large states. You know, some states are geographically large and they're rural. And so the challenge of how to provide service at a distance, either over the internet or over the phone or by mail, had already come to them. It's just a basic feature of that state and how people are distributed across that state. Even if you have a DMV branch office in every county seat, some of the counties are as big as the state I live in. So you know, how do you provide services to people who might be 50 miles from, you know, 50 miles, 100 miles from their nearest DMV branch office? So the concept of online digital service, and it ties into some of our other themes of privacy, of data security, you know, there are clear advantages to digitizing everything in those areas too. DMVs were well aware of the need to start to move toward a distance forward service model. As Nate said, all COVID did was accelerate it and make it an imperative.
Yeah, and pair that with the proof in the pudding of telework, you know, working. So combine those two.
So all of those topics, you know, have this common thread of shifting technology, advancing technology for future mobility, telework, forward service is in many ways tied to topics of technology. And then you have this other space that you started to allude to there when you talk about, you know, the different geography of jurisdictions of rural versus urban where people live, which is what you talked about at the outset, Nathan, which is analyzing shifting demographics and how that relates to what we call in the paper service for everyone. So talk to me about what the conversation was about, how those demographics are shifting and how that affects how DMVs want to be thinking about serving customers.
Yeah, so demographics are shifting. We're in a country where there's a lot of aging people. The aging population is growing. We also have the population of people is also making different decisions relative to driving. We're seeing more older people wanting to get their driver's license or keep their driver's license as a way to keep mobility and keep social and, you know, do the things they need to do to live. And for a while we saw younger people becoming less licensed, getting fewer licenses. And although that sort of ticked back up as the economy picked up again, so we're not exactly sure what might happen there. But, you know, to your other point about the technology and the demographics, these things are linked, right? You know, one of the big things, the takeaways that I took from the work was this issue of the distance forward kind of service and the aging population together. You know, how do you ensure that people who probably are more comfortable with brick and mortar kinds of interactions can use the distance forward service? So I think, you know, those are some of the key demographic trends that we pulled out in the paper, for sure.
Yeah, to maybe also lay out in detail what we found in terms of demographics. You know, we found really two trends, one with younger drivers and one with older drivers. The trend with older drivers was that their numbers are increasing substantially. The Maryland DMV has done excellent, Motor Vehicle Administration, I apologize, the Maryland Motor Vehicle Administration, has done excellent work over time charting out the number of licenses they issue by age group. And what they found was over the past 10 years, the number of drivers in the over 60 age bracket has increased massively, you know, by 100 to 200% per bucket. So that's, you know, one half, one side of the coin. The other side of the coin is that over the course of the 2010s, there was a lot of discussion of whether younger drivers, younger people, were not associating with car culture for whatever reason. There was data that suggested that post-recession, younger people were no longer being licensed at age 16 and were waiting until they needed a car for some other purpose. And so that raised some questions. Is this a generation that is more aware of the environmental externalities of driving? Do they live in places where their entertainment is closer to home, or is there entertainment in their home? If they, you know, to be an oldster for a second at, you know, my advanced age of 31, you know, they're sitting around all day playing video games. You know, do they not need to go places anymore and therefore not need a car? There was research over the past several years that challenged that, both by AAA, the research arm of AAA, also by a researcher named Joanna Moody at MIT, among other people, who concluded largely that the economic hardship of the recession, the fact that teens and young people were having trouble entering the job market, was more to blame than any cultural factor. And that as that generation made money, they were adopting car culture. They were getting their licenses and buying cars at a rate that would have caught up with prior generations. Then COVID happened. So that was where we were at the start of the project. And then COVID happened and blew that whole thing up. So I think just to give a little bit of additional context as to what we found. In terms of commercial drivers, to Nate's point, there is a longstanding observation in the trucking industry and trucking industry groups and lobbying organizations that there is a catastrophic shortage of commercial drivers and people you know, wanting to enter that as a career. And there's a number of reasons identified for that, right? Again, you have this cultural question of, do young people want to do this for work? It is a challenging career from a personal life and family standpoint to be a trucker, especially a long distance trucker. There are some financial challenges to you know, being a private contractor, working for a company, owning your own truck. There are also regulatory challenges to being licensed in different states and commercial licensing and permitting reciprocity across state lines. And you know, you add all of that up, and there is a significant shortfall, both currently and projected, in the number of commercial drivers we have versus what we need. So in essence, a lot of studies on the future of truck transportation have identified a race, as it were, between the shortage of commercial drivers and the advance of autonomous trucks. And when the trucks start to drive themselves, either entirely or with a human in the front truck and autonomous trucks behind in what's called a platoon, where you have three or four trucks making, in essence, a train on the highway with only one driver at the front and the rest of them following along through some computer program and tracking with sensors where the trucks ahead of them are and where they're going. There's a demographic element to that. There's also a future mobility element to commercial driving. To go to a point, to maybe also shed a little bit of more detail on a point that Nate brought up. What you described as service for everyone, which is how we're referring to it now that the project is complete, is really a combination of two trends that we identified in the course of the research and in the synthesis. One is the demographic trends, the young and aging drivers. The other was the idea of the DMV as a front door. We called it front door services, I believe, initially. Those two became inextricably linked, because if you're going to be providing service to everyone and meeting them where they are, you have to take account of their age cohort. You have to take account of the generation they're in and their comfort with technology. But on the flip side of that, that kind of valorizes comfort with technology. On the other side, comfort with interpersonal interaction as a millennial. I can also valorize the notion that folks older than me may just be more comfortable interacting with people in a service setting. And that can be a great thing, too. So how do you meet folks where they are and provide them the services that they need in the way that they are most comfortable? Because as we implied with the term front door service, those services are really important. The DMV is the doorway to so much in state government. It's where you sign up for a toll tag. It's where you register to vote in some states. It is where you establish your residency. One of the things that we promoted in the project is adding more and more services to the DMV, linking it with more and more things. You can establish a bank account there when you move into a state, for instance, if we're still even doing bank accounts in different states. And that leads into things that some states are already doing. Virginia, for instance, brings DMV services directly to senior centers and youth centers, literally meeting people in different age cohorts where they are, and we definitely wanted to highlight efforts like that. So I think just to maybe build on some of the prior points.
That notion of the DMV as the front door and meeting people where they are, I think, one of the other interesting things that means to me and what I came out of this research is that if you're licensing the five big technology companies to do automated driving, how do you remain the front door to state government as a DMV? I think is one of the big questions to answer.
And the answer?
Well, it's wrapped into all these things, meeting your customers where they are, making sure that you're providing the services, but also thinking about, how you want to get. It probably ties into the regulatory framework of how you get folks into the DMV to make sure that you've got folks registered and that they have IDs and all of the other things that typically come through with getting your license that you may no longer have to do. So
you may not need that individual driver's license, but mm-hmm. you still need that portal to state government services. That DMV could be that front door to serve the citizens.
Yep, exactly.
And even though you may not need that individual driver's license, you would still need that individual identity and mm-hmm. still as the, you know, the manager of individual identity, DMV can still be that front door of that credentialing, though the credentialing, to your point, may change exactly what's being credentialed or how it's being credentialed. It still plays that role in that credential provider.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You're absolutely right. DMVs do genuinely serve as the official registrar of residents. You know, the Massachusetts calls their DMV the registrar, and that is an accurate description of one of the roles that the DMV has. And that puts them in the position of managing a lot of personally identifiable data that they have to keep safe. So that's a trend too.
So you naturally bridged us there to kind of the last theme that's identified in the paper, is that issue of privacy, that where it's almost where everything else kind of comes together as the holder of all these moving parts of connection, integration, and privacy, I believe is the label that you use to kind of cover those last bit of trends that we haven't talked about in the paper.
Yeah. And there's a number of different elements to that, right? There's the question of how do DMVs keep people's precious personally identifiable information safe? There's also the question of how do DMVs do that without impinging on what people consider an appropriate amount of data for the government to have about them and who they give it to and who they share it with. You know, one of the things we dug down on in the interviews with, you know, all the way back in 2019 was questions of who do you share data with and how do you share that data? DMVs can have data requested by courts, by lawyers, by insurance companies. You know, how do you manage that access? You know, we just saw a case in California of a third party data manager who manages your data, who stores your data. Are they secure? So yeah, it opens up a lot of different sides. And the reality is that not every DMV stores data in the same way. There are DMVs that continue to operate on in-house mainframe data storage solutions that run on things like COBOL, you know, go back to computer and digital structures from the 1980s. And there are DMVs that have migrated into the cloud. And so security solutions and privacy solutions are naturally going to vary from DMV to DMV, depending on what data storage solution they are most comfortable with. You know, you can't apply the same security solution in every single state, in every single province, every single case, because the needs are just so different. But the central need is the same. The central need is to keep that data safe.
And I think that one of the things that we also saw over the last year was just an increasing number of cyber attacks, that large-scale cyber attacks that are impacting third-party vendors who are providing the so-called plumbing of, you know, the internet technology within the IT of these organizations, and by nefarious actors from around the world who are looking to do different things. And I think that how pervasive that is it's unavoidable that once you have PII, you know, personal data, that you are going to have to be proactive about managing it and protecting it from those cyber attacks at this point.
So as you were all working on this project, I know that you each have background in transportation. I imagine you really hadn't dived this deeply into the DMV world previously. So I'm curious, from your individual perspectives, what surprised you the most? What'd you find that you didn't expect to find as you looked into, you know, what the DMV of the future might look like, or anything you just learned about the DMV and the way this business works that perhaps surprised you?
Sure. So I think surprised maybe is not the right word. I came away from this entire year and a half tremendously impressed with the thoughtful people who work in DMVs. You know, over and over again, as we speak to DMV executives, either in the workshop or in the interviews, or in preparing for some of the other AMVA activities that we're participating in over the next month or two, you know, these folks are really, really smart. They understand their agencies. They understood these trends already. They understand the impact that COVID is having. They're thoughtful about the possibilities for what comes next in the next few years. A lot of them are very, very heavily technologically literate and understand the data systems and technological systems, smartphone systems that their agencies can use. So our role as researchers here, as Nate said all the way back at the beginning, was not so much to tell people things they didn't know, but to collate a lot of wisdom from a lot of smart people into a document that could be referenced by other smart people who may just not have thought of that yet. I wouldn't call that a surprise. I think that was gratifying because, as you said, we weren't, I had never worked with DMVs before. And so to discover how great a group of people are members of AMVA was very gratifying. It made this project very fun.
I think I would, the things that I saw that were different, maybe that I wouldn't say, I wouldn't necessarily say surprised, but the things that I would highlight as different from my prior work are that DMVs very much have a strong focus on the customer, as they should. As we were talking about before, it's the front door to the state or provincial agencies. And I think that when you look at other kinds of transportation work, it's a bit more general in nature how you interact with the public. That's not the case here. And so that raised all kinds of issues around, this personal identifiable information and how you think about brick and mortar and how you think about the actual literal and digital front door of the agency that I found really interesting. If you're thinking about putting a road out there, that's just not something that you need to think about those things. The other thing is that one of the things that I felt like may have been a little bit different is that our work typically brings us towards thinking about the future and wrestling with these scenarios. And I felt like our long range strategy kinds of thinking was applicable to DMVs and useful for DMVs to maybe push beyond what the next 3 to 5 years look like to maybe what the next 10 to 20 or 30 years look like. And so I think that good kind of tension, brought out the best in the research project.
So I want to finish where you started, Nathan, which is that the whole purpose of it was to get practitioners to produce a report that would be a practical tool for folks who read it. And so for those that have read it or haven't read it or are now going to go and download it from amva.org and take a read at it, what would be your 2-sentence, this is how you should use this report?
I think you should use this report looking at the trends and the potential futures. And really, I think that the report does a good job of synthesizing everything down to these few potential futures with some key questions that you need to ask yourself. If you do none of the other reading of the material, and you can take home these questions about, is my DMV prepared for this? Then I think that you can put that into practice by being honest with yourself about those answers.
I think that if you take, as is the case with any research report, that asks you to consider the future, or asks you to consider trends in other parts of the country or the continent that you may not have considered, if you take one insight away from this and say, my agency could do, this is such an exciting idea, my agency could really run with this. You take that one nugget of a concept and try to implement it and try to put a project together, try to put a pilot together. Even if it's something as small as, here's a group of our employees that have been underworked during the pandemic. They're sitting at home and I'm worried that they're underengaged. Let's have them go out and try to set up this initiative for when we come back you know, when we reopen our brick and mortar locations after the pandemic, that we're going to have a demand management system. You know, we're going to try to track people coming in the door. We're going to try to set up one kiosk in one DMV location that has, you know, openly is advertised as an experiment and just has a mock-up on it. And we're going to collect people's impressions as they come in the door of a possible kiosk-based welcoming solution. You know, really anything. If you have any idea after reading this and you know, you think to yourself that you can try to do it and, you know, try to bring it to some sort of reality, then the project's been a success. Cause that's, you know, we're taking insights from, AMVA members and DMV executives all across, these two countries and we're trying to, spread them around.
Well, Nathan, Joe, thank you for spending some time with us today to talk about this report. We've already heard great feedback from our members that have been able to access the report and read the report, and I think are using the report in many of the ways that both of you are talking about, and hopefully either listening to you chat today or seeing your presentations at our conferences, it'll continue to be that useful tool that we set it out to be when AMVA partnered with TRB 18 months ago. So thank you both again. We want to thank all our listeners for tuning in. Maybe we'll even have two of you back in 5 years and see how much of this has held true or not. If folks are still out there willing to download a podcast and listen to Ian chat with folks in 5 years. But at least for now, thank you all for listening. Thanks to our producer, Claire Jeffrey. And we'll see you all the next time on the AmvaCast. Stay well, everyone.
Thank you for joining us for AmvaCast, hosted by Ian Grossman, produced by Claire Jeffrey, music by Gibson Arthur. This episode was brought to you by Fast Enterprises. Visit us at amvacast.podbean.com and subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, and Spotify.